I mean, I came here feeling miserable and went on a gluttony feast of calls. Turn me down a little bit, I'm too loud. I guess you figured out it's live now. Turn the lights down. Now here is the book that Craig was supposed to get that he can't get. Berkeley Press owns the rights. They can't get it out till January, so we said, you know, why can't we just pay your royalty and print it ourselves? We can get it done faster than that. So today I told Craig to go back to Prentice Hall and get me a hardback copy. I'll give you something really fancy if you can get that done. I'm going to get this book, Demonology. I just hate to get on this subject because everybody thinks I'm crazy. And then I rested myself for a while from the feeling of inferiority and fear that you would completely write me off as a first-class nut. Make sure it's a first-class nut. And I said, well, the book's not here yet, so let's read a little more in it. Ed picks up the discussion. This is the Demonologist, The Extraordinary Career of Ed and Lorraine Warren by Gerald Brittle. Ed picks up the discussion. He's just returned from England. By the way, there's a scenario going on that I'm getting clippings on. It's happening right now. We're having people check it out. And I may read about it to you. I mean, I'd be hot off the press. I mean, a real live poltergeist. Ed picks up the discussion. He's just returned from England the day before. His trip to the United Kingdom was to visit a family in whose home inhuman spirit phenomena have been occurring with increasing regularity over the past 3 years. It was Ed's third visit to Enfield in the last year alone. This time, the purpose of his visit was to gather evidence of the phenomena occurring in the house, which could be used as proof for the need to exercise the premises. Remember, in the Donovan case and in the Devil in Connecticut case and all these cases, these are Catholic lay people. They don't exercise a place without formal church permission. And to obtain that, evidence is gathered to support the claim that inhuman spirits inhabit the place. This Enfield case makes Amityville look like a playhouse. There ain't no way Amityville would look like a playhouse. This Enfield case makes Amityville look like a playhouse, says Ed. I mean that truly. The Lutzes were able, those are the Amityville people, the Lutzes were able to move out after 28 days of terror. This is a case where the people can't move out for economic reasons. I mean, there are some things worse than being broke. And I've had to put up with the disturbance for 3 years. I mean, if I couldn't solve my economic problem in 3 years, I'd at least run from the devil. Those who have been victimized, as the London press has exhaustively reported, are a divorced 50-year-old woman and her 3 children who live together in a government-supported... That's it? Government-supported. There it is. In a government-supported council house in the North London suburb of Enfield. Wherever you get in the clutches... I mean, that's what happens to you when you get in the clutches of the government. Economic and devil oppression. In the family, there are 2 girls, age 15 and 12 at this time, and a boy of 8. Though phenomena first erupted in August 1977, the case began in 1976, when the 2 girls grew inhuman entities into the house after playing with, you guessed it, a Ouija board. I mean, these warnings, they really got themselves a case against the Ouija board. The girls had no sinister purpose in using it. They simply had nothing else to do and were playing with the board as a game. That's why I try to keep you folks busy. Unfortunately for them, London is a spiritually active place. As a result, the girls made contact with a demonic spirit that did its thing. And wrangled permission out of the girls to enter the house. This has widened my pupils so much I can read anyway. A few weeks later. A few weeks later, this spirit infested their home. But it didn't come alone. It brought 6 buddies along. There ain't no way you should ever refer to a demon as a buddy. I mean, even, you know, a little bit of license goes along with literary expression, but that's carrying it too far. Those 6 spirits are present in the home right now as I'm speaking. Quote, when the spirits were first drawn in, the usual run of infestation phenomena erupted. Knockings, rappings, scratchings, poundings, and so forth. As time went on, the phenomena upgraded. I'm telling you, by the time this guy gets to the last chapter, he's really lost his style. You don't upgrade demonic phenomena. I mean, they need to let me just rewrite this book. I mean, I could tell the story and not misuse phrases. The phenomena downgraded or outgraded, didn't upgrade. Objects materialized. People levitated, especially the girls. Object materialized, levitated, especially the girls. Joe. Finally, I gotta shut these loudmouths up in here. What have they been drinking before I got here? That eggnog you brought me didn't have any nog in it. As time went on, the phenomena upgraded. Objects materialized. People levitated, especially the girls. I ain't never seen a levitated girl. And a number of black forms manifested and floated around the house at night. After the mother. Joe, you call Chris and you tell her to tell Jim to send my pipe bag. I gotta get this place warmed up. This is getting scary. You got that, Joe?
Yes, I got
Joe. Pipe bag. Black forms. A number of black forms manifested and floated around the house at night. After the mother reported the problem to the local police, Constabulary. The police investigated the complaint. That's what they were, constabulary. They were police. Not just police, police. The police investigated the complaint, but to no avail. Why has Gloria been delirious for two nights in a row? In no time at all, however, the press got wind of the case. And reporters, you know, you ain't fooling me. When I get back on this subject, you're scared like a bunch of kids and trying to overcompensate. In no time at all, however, the press got wind of the case, and reporters and psychic researchers descended on this brick row house. They'll never believe me, so let's... Brick. Row House. And between 1977 and 1978, they not only put the family in the public eye, they thoroughly documented the reality of the phenomena occurring there. Then they went away without anyone once telling these people how they could get rid of the disturbance. I mean, you think the news media is going to eliminate something that's newsworthy? In fact, it seems no one even knew what was happening. The case had been dubbed the so-called poltergeist attack and was left at that. Ed's still talking. When I was in England in the summer of 1978, the case was brought to my attention and I visited the family. At that time, Ed goes on, I spent a week in Enfield. I thoroughly interviewed all the members of the family, separately and together, while witnessing the phenomena go on around me in the house. As a demonologist, I was able to see that these individuals were being systematically oppressed and sometimes even possessed by inhuman spirits. For example, the girls would levitate off the floor, crisscross in the air, and then be set back down again in a display of inhuman power. I can't read this. Ain't no way I can read this. I'm telling you. I was smart when I laid it aside and started talking about Jeremiah. I mean, this is just too unbelievable. It's so unbelievable, it makes my nose run. Can't believe it. People, I just get my credibility built up, and here I go again. But it's interesting. Every week, in fact, it seemed one or the other of these two girls would be subject to levitation, often in the company of witnesses. The mother told me she has walked into the girl's bedroom and found her younger daughter sound asleep, levitating in midair. I just don't believe this. I don't believe this. On other occasions, she has witnessed her daughters rise up and down on the bed like a yo-yo, as she says, with none of them able to control the activity. The children also spoke about a black mass that manifests itself in their bedrooms at night and terrorizes them with its presence. Ed's still talking. Even as I talked with the family, things would rise up in the air and float around the room. I'd quit talking. One evening, a wooden chair lifted up in the air, stayed still for a minute, then exploded. I don't believe this. On another occasion, a big, hefty rock, the size of a softball, manifested out of thin air in the middle of the living room and slammed to the floor with a thud. I later took that rock to a geologist at the University of London without telling him where I got it. I simply asked the professor to tell me where the rock could have come from. The stone, he said, is indigenous to only one place in the British Isles. That place is the Isle of Wight. The Isle of Wight is white or right? Well, it says white. That must have got to be it. We need to reprint this book. White. The Isle of Wight. I didn't know there was an Isle of Wight. I thought it was the Isle of Wight. My geography gone to pot. The Isle of Wight is located, of course, in the English Channel, some 25 miles southwest of London as the crow flies. More serious than the outward phenomena, Ed continues, is what's happening to the children in this home. I wouldn't believe this if it weren't for the credibility of the Warrens. I'd believe it. If you told me, Jerry, or if you told me, Mike. But I'd say, don't tell me out loud. Because ain't nobody going to believe us. The girls in particular are coming under episodes of possession where they take on the features of an old dead woman, according to the mother, and have the strength of an Amazon. The most dangerous feature of the possession episodes is that one of the daughters is often caused to attack her mother and attempts to kill her with her bare hands, and a number of times she's almost succeeded. A few weeks before I arrived, one of the girls came under possession. After the possessing entity stalked around the house, it put the girl in a state of agitated frenzy. The mother was forced to bring the daughter to a local hospital where doctors worked for 6 or 7 hours trying to bring her out of it. The incident suddenly stopped after the spirit withdrew from her body, at which time she got up and simply walked out of the casualty ward. By far, though, the most compelling aspect to this case is the physicalized voice manifestations that occur in the house. The voices of 6 different spirits talk out loud in the room. It's as though there were 6 invisible people present. It's incredible. You can't believe it even when you're there. Even while the family is eating in the kitchen, the voices are speaking in another room. The British Society for Psychical Research, who worked on the case before I came in, went over the house with a fine-tooth comb and determined that in no way were the voices being projected by loudspeakers or by any other electronic means. The voices themselves speak with a distinct Cockney accent. The demonic spirit is a mimic, so here it speaks in Cockney because the family can understand it, although one of the spirits does lapse off into German when it prefers. And these voices are not a matter of some occasional phrase or sentence. They talk all the time. These spirits not only talk out loud to the people in the room when no one's addressing them, they talk to each other. They talk more than the people do. think some of them are in here tonight. The British Society for Psychical Research have their own recordings of these spirit voices, but because their organization is private, the evidence has so far not been made available to the general public. I went there for the express purpose of getting these voices on tape, which could be used to document the need for exorcism as they went to the Catholic Church. Did Ed get a recording of the voices? Did Ed get a recording of the voices? Did Ed get a recording of the voices? You better believe it, he replies, tapping a pair of cassettes before him on the table. Although it'll take some time before the contents of these tapes can be analyzed, the evidence is right here. And in my estimation, it represents some of the most important evidence yet on the existence of the inhuman spirit. I'll play them now. The tapes run for well over 3 hours. What comes across on them is something truly incredible. The recordings were made while Ed and his two assistants, Paul Bartz and John Kennyhertz, interviewed the mother and her three children in the infield home. While the three men were questioning the family, other voices, those of spirits, can be heard speaking out loud in the room at the same time. Let's put the lights out. Go pull the wallpaper down. Throw the table. Stop him from going into that room. Were among the many comments the voices made when not being addressed by human beings in the house. Once, ever so often, a bizarre, parrot-like voice interjected itself, saying only, "Hello." Sometimes, the other spirits joined the parrot voice in a round of hellos. Are you all ready to take the consequences of mocking the reality of these spirits? Not all the sounds produced by the spirits were in the form of language. Fully 10% of the recording is taken up with grunts, moans, yicks, and the imitation of animal sounds, of which the most often repeated is that of a barking dog. As for communicating with these spirits, there was no evident problem. Sometimes the spirits address the people in the room. Sometimes the people in the room address the spirits. The quality of the voices is extremely raspy and guttural. The elocution is definitely cockney. In fact, so cockney it's quite hard for the American ear to sort out. The quality of the spirit statement would place them low on a scale of human intelligence, though they're far from ignorant. Most every question put to the spirits was answered. Although the inhuman voices usually supplied straight, rational replies, much of what they said was also nonsensical and capricious. There was a predominating voice in the crowd, and on this occasion, the spirit took the identity of Fred. It was to Fred that Ed Warren addressed most of his questions. What follows is an extract of that interrogation. Ed Warren. Hello. Voice. Hello. Ed Warren. Do you know who I am? Voice. Yeah. Who am I? Ed. That's right, Ed. Who are you? Freddy. You're Freddy, huh? What's your real name?
Yes.
When are you going to leave here, Fred? 500 years. That's a long time. Can you move something to show us you're here? No. Why not? Tommy pulled my arm out. Oh, there's two of you. Put Tommy on. A new voice, though still gruff and guttural. Yeah, I'm Tommy. Ed, Tommy, how do you think we could get rid of all the problems that are happening in this house? Voice, kill the ghosties. Ed, kill the ghosties. Are you a ghostie? Voice, no. Ed, tell me, how did you get into this house? Voice, came up from under the floorboards. Ed, how many of you are there altogether? Counting slowly and deliberately, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six are here. No, 5. Ed, what are the names? Freddie, Tommy, Billy, Charlie, and Dick. John's not here. Where's John? Don't know. Who's the leader? Are you the leader? No. Nobody. Nobody's the leader. I'm a liar. Who else is here? Is there anyone else here? Yeah. Who? Gutterman's here. Put Gutterman on. Let him speak. You were there, Gutterman? Yeah. Gutterman, what do you have to say? They want to know. Now, the Enfield case makes Amityville look like a playhouse. I doubt that. But there were inhuman spirits infesting this house, and Ed recorded a conversation with their voices, invisible voices. Where's John? Don't know. Who's the leader? You the leader? No, nobody's the leader. I'm a liar. Who else is here? Is there anyone else here? Yeah. This is Ed Warren carrying on a conversation and recording it with these demon voices. Turn the lights down. Who else is here? Is there anyone else here? Yeah. Who? Gutterman's here. Put Gutterman on. Let him speak. Are you there, Gutterman? Yeah. Different guttural voice. This one a bit clearer. Gutterman, what do you have to say? Ed Warren asked. Voice. Yelping noises. This house is haunted. Kill the ghosties. Ed Warren. Gutterman, were you ever alive? Voice. Yeah. Ed, where? Voice, in soldiers. I'm a soldier. Ed, in whose army are you a soldier? Voice, all armies. I'm a soldier. Ed, who else is here, Gutterman? Voice, Zachary's here. Ed, put him on, Gutterman. Let Zachary speak. Voice. Suddenly there's an incredible moaning and groaning. The voice is utterly bizarre. The wailing ends up in a long cry of help, and it takes 10 seconds to come out. What was that? Ed said. Put Zachary back on. Voice. Woeful mourning recurs. Ed, who else is here, Fred? Voice. I ain't Fred, I'm Tommy. Ed, put Fred on. Fred, are you there? Voice, yeah, Fred's here. Voice change indicates Fred speaking. Ed, Fred, put Zachary back on. Voice, won't come. I'll tell you someone else who's here. Teddy's here. Teddy man's here. Ed, put Teddy man on, Fred. Yeah! Noise. Then silence, broken every few seconds by a parrot-like voice saying, hello. The second voice then picks up and says, hello. To which the parrot voice responds with 2 hellos. A third voice joins in the hellos. Then a fourth voice chimes in with it, hello. Then a fifth and a sixth voice join in, forming a chorus of parrot-like voices all saying, hello. Which build finally into loud, wild shrieks. The additional voices then fall away, leaving the original parrot voice repeating its singular, hello. All the while I was talking to these spirits, Ed notes during a lull in the tape, things were flying around the room. That's what those crashing and bumping sounds are in the background on the tape, he explains to the author who's listening to it. Chairs and tables were lifting and dropping. Small, little objects would whiz across the room, bounce off the wall. In the dining room, the wallpaper was peeling away from the walls as we watched. A butcher knife materialized in the lap of my assistant, Paul. A nail was also produced out of thin air. And as has come to be expected in the house, the spirits left excrement on the mother's bedroom carpet upstairs at 3 in the afternoon. When the spirits on the recording weren't going through a fit of random insanity, they seemed to amuse themselves by filling the room with grunts and quacks, barks, shrieks, and a variety of other animal sounds, the most annoying being that of a shrill, screeching cat. One particular spirit put out a tortuous, unworldly howl which brought on another exchange. I just don't believe this. But I believe Ed Warren. The tape takes on with the continues on with the conversation. Ed, you guys sound like something right out of hell. You know where hell is, Fred? Voice, yeah. Ed, where is hell, Fred? Voice, yeah. Ed, how old are you, Fred? Voice, 16. Ed, are you a ghost, Fred? Voice, no, yet, I'm a ghost. Ed, who? Voice, Batman, I'm Batman. Ed, Batman isn't a ghost. Voice, spirits lapse into an array of animal sounds, the most predominant being that of a barking dog. Ed, you want to be animals? Imitate some animals, imitate a pig. Voice, snorted like a pig. Ed, how about a dog? Voice, barking. Ed, how about a cat? Loud, screeching meow. Ed, how about a turkey? Voice, gobblings. Ed, how old are you, Fred? 78. I'm a liar. Tommy's a liar. Ed, I know. Voice, can I sing a song? Ed, sure, Fred. Go ahead and sing. La-dee-da-dee-da. Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of holy water. Ha, ha, ha. Ed, are you a Christian, Fred? Voice, yick, a soldier, I'm a soldier. Ed, when did you die, Fred, as a soldier? Voice, I'm always dead. Ed, were you ever married, Fred? You ever have a wife? Voice, yeah. Ed, what was her name? Voice, I don't know. How old are you now? 30. I'm 30. That's the third different age he's given. You know what day it is? Yeah. The 7th. Right. Do you know what month it is? August. 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 August 7th. Where'd you get those names, Fred, Tommy, and Billy, and so on? The graves. Do you go over the old graveyard near here? Yeah. Why? To read the graves. You like the graveyard, Fred? Why do you like the graveyard? Death. What do you think of us Americans? I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. Do you know where America is, Fred? I don't know. Can I come? No, Fred. I got enough to do without you. Ed, Ed, Ed. What do you want, Fred? Smash the recorder. You'd like that, wouldn't you? Yeah. Ed. You know what I'm going to do with these tapes, Fred? I'm going to play them to some scientists I know in America. They're going to be very interested in you, Fred. Voice, I'm going to smash it in the night. A quarrel then develops between two spirits as to who's going to smash the tape recorder. As the voices rise from the level of argument to one against one, yikes and howls, Ed sends Paul out to the car to get a bottle of holy water drawn from Walsingham Shrine, north of London. Paul returns to report the bottle of holy water is missing. Ed, where's the holy water, Fred? Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Voice, I slung it. Ed, you slung it. If you don't bring that holy water back, we're going to perform an exorcism on you. Voice, ha, ha, ha. Ed, you want me to bring a priest in here? Yeah, all right, bring him in. I'll kick him in the backside. What would you say if the Blessed Mother told you to leave, Fred? Yeah, Clark. You know what this is, Fred? What do you see? A cross. That's right. It said a cross. The cross means your day's numbered here. Voice, I'm going to chop somebody's head off. The next time I come back here, Fred, you better be gone, because the next time I come, I'm bringing a very powerful exorcist with me, someone you won't want to mess with. Voice. Ed. 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 Edward. Ed says, what is it, Fred? Voice. Let's play exorcist. Go get the holy water. Having played the recording, Lorraine suddenly jumps up from the couch and strides purposefully to the bedroom door. She then calls to Ed. Upon checking, the room reeks of alcohol, and on Lorraine's dresser, an ornamental crucifix set in a grotto is turned upside down. Oh, you don't want me to go on. I can tell by your attitude tonight, you think this is funny. My audience here doesn't appreciate these phenomenal stories. I'll take their names tonight, and when Craig finally gets this book, I'll see to it they don't get any copies. I'm going to ask the people out there again. You want me to continue with this demonology stuff? You still want to? Shall we just give up on this book?
No, sir.
I mean, there are a lot of unfinished things I haven't finished yet in this book. I've just scratched the surface. I was going to read a lot of it tonight. But these people in here tonight are too disrespectful. They're to blame. I want to check with you out there, see if you've got a little more sober perspective on this subject. I'm reading from The Demonologist, The Extraordinary Career of Ed and Lorraine Warren, by Gerald Brittle, the book we've been trying to get for you. Put this flamethrower again tonight. And finally, there is the black lace veil. 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 I don't want to intimidate you till you can't sort of anticipate with me. Just remember it's a serious subject. And finally, there is the black lace veil. The veil figured in a case of possession where an inhuman spirit delivered a pointed message to Ed Warren. The possessing entity's voice was clearly recorded on tape. The Warrens, sitting together in an overstuffed or on an overstuffed sofa in the occult museum, now explain the strange case of the young woman who had one day been brought into Ed's office with other spirit-related problems. Turn the lights down. Ed and I had been lecturing to a college audience, Lorraine began. It was an otherwise normal lecture, except that I could sense there was a negative presence in the auditorium. Well, I've done that. And for the life of me, I couldn't pick it out. When we speak to groups of people, I can usually tell who's there. Clergymen, for instance, often come wearing turtlenecks or sports shirts. But I can see their clergy by the light beige aura that surrounds the ordained. I didn't know that. Perfectly okay to laugh at me, as long as you don't laugh about the demons. Satanists and black witchcraft groups often show up at our lectures, dressed like everyone else. But their auras stand out too. Now, you remember Lorraine was a parapsychologist, psychic. Ed wasn't. He's just a demonologist. On this occasion, however, I just couldn't locate the source of the negative vibrations. When the question session was over, people from the audience came forward as usual. A dozen people surrounded Ed and a dozen people surrounded me. After about 15 minutes, I looked over and saw that Ed was speaking with a young male student. Next to the boy stood a girl who for some reason was seething with rage. I promptly excused myself from the group around me and went over to be with Ed. Alan, the boy who had been talking to me, says Ed, brought his girlfriend Lonnie to our lecture because he suspected that she had been overtaken by some occult influence. He told me that when his girlfriend became angry, she would fill up with intense hate and rage, her features would change into something resembling a wolf, and then the voice of a different person would speak from inside her. Now, if you think that's strange, read the New Testament, the first few chapters of Mark, until he comes upon the demoniac of the Gadarenes. When Lorraine came over to me, the girl experienced an episode of instantaneous possession right there on the stage. She lurched out and actually tried to kill Lorraine. The incident not only scared Lorraine, it also scared the wits out of everyone else around us, who quickly moved away. We ended the audience chat session right there. I took Lonnie and her boyfriend to an offstage room. In the meantime, Lonnie waited out in the hall while I spoke with these two. In the backstage room, the girl was fully under possession. She was breathing heavily while the entity possessing her was completely overtaken with an intense, violent hatred. Her facial features were also somewhat transformed into the wolf-like appearance the boy had talked about. The off-pitch voice projected by the entity later proved to be dissimilar to that of the girl. I didn't have a tape recorder with me at the time, but it hardly mattered because the thing possessing the girl was simply caught up in a snarling, accusatory rage. After about 10 minutes, the possession passed. Then the girl seemed to be all right, at least if I didn't crowd her, which seemed to reinstigate possession. So to avoid trouble, I sat on the opposite side of the room, Ed's telling this story. When I felt she could be spoken to, I told her about the incident I'd just witnessed. She told me she had some slight awareness of her condition, though what she complained about was a loss of memory that made her think she was losing her mind. She couldn't account for hours and even whole days in her life. Over the course of the previous 3 months, she explained, this had been getting worse. I told her that loss of memory went hand in hand with possession, because there was nothing for her to remember. The gaps in time represented episodes of possession where life was being experienced not by her, but by the possessing entity. Yet before anything could be done for the girl, the real question that had to be answered was, why had she been experiencing possession at all? Lonnie, I found out, was a well-to-do, perhaps even spoiled, young lady. Now, this is the book that we've been trying to get for you. I don't want you to forget it in the long time that we're taking getting it printed. We are going to get it printed so you can finish some of the stories I haven't had time to finish. And you'll get it at King's House 1. It'll be given to everyone who attends there. Lonnie, I found out, was well-to-do, perhaps even spoiled, on the Sunday that we give it away. Just want that clear. Whichever Sunday Craig finally manages to get it, that's the Sunday we give it away. No other day. Lonnie, I found out, was well-to-do, perhaps even spoiled, young lady, who was wealthy enough to buy anything she wanted. About a year earlier, however, there came a point in her life when she encountered something money couldn't buy. That something was the young man sitting next to her, Alan, enrolled at an Ivy League school in a nearby state. Lonnie had met him in her hometown the summer before, and apparently they'd went out on a few dates. By the end of the summer, though, the boy had no feeling for Lonnie and ignored her approaches. She, on the other hand, had seized on this guy passionately. Couldn't rest until she made him her own. In essence, she saw Alan as a desirable commodity, not as a human being. This dehumanization of a person got noticed. I say this because the girl tried every possible method to gain the boy's affection, from writing him enticing letters to sending him money for travel tickets so he could visit her at school. But none of the tactics worked, at least not until she hit upon ritual witchcraft, which is where the black lace veil comes in. To get Alan in her clutches, she turned to the occult. Lonnie went out to a store and found herself a book on the black arts, the title of which I won't mention. Lonnie took the book home later that week, privately performed a ritual for acquiring lovers. An old ritual that has gotten people in trouble for ages. The Warrens are often reluctant to give precise details, such as the names of conjuring books, the specific ritual of witchcraft an individual used, or the names of spirits responsible for particular demonic attacks. Why? I don't mention the names of spirits, says Ed, because knowing a particular demonic name is to give recognition to that entity. If you give it recognition, no matter how small, you're going to give it fuel to manifest. As for specifics, let me put it this way. If you give someone a loaded gun, they're liable to fire it. If you give them a loaded gun with a firing pin taken out, there's no danger of it going off. That's what I do. I take the firing pin out of my statements. Ed then resumes. The essence of black witchcraft is a pact with the devil. And women who make such pacts become, in effect, brides of the devil on earth. Now, insofar as the devil is called the prince of the earth, the devil's bride need only ask her husband for earthly pleasures, and supposedly they're hers. The only hitch is that before any of these benefits come to the witch, she's got to give her soul willingly to the devil. Lonnie was mercenary enough to go through with such a pact. Part of the paraphernalia was the black lace mantilla, which she wore as a perverse wedding veil, on top of which she placed a crown of goat horns. Next, she married herself into evil by renouncing God and her baptism and swearing allegiance to Satan. She finalized the ritual by washing down the vow with a cup of animal blood. The cup, says Ed, pointing to the oak table in the middle of the occult museum, is there with the veil and the goat horns. As Ed and Lorraine have delivered many people, they've taken the relics and formed this museum. About a month after Lonnie performed the ritual, and by the way, that's the only thing I'd fault them on. I think they ought to burn them. About a month after Lonnie performed the ritual, the girl explained that Alan started to take an interest in her. He'd been calling on the phone, eventually started visiting her on weekends. For Lonnie, things were hunky-dory. What she hadn't counted on, however, that she was in debt to the demonic. By performing the witchcraft ritual, Lonnie had given permission for the demonic to enter her life. Ordinarily, the witchcraft formula she used would have attracted other incubus, the sexual oppressor of women, or succubus, the sexual oppressor of men, but in her case, it drew a lesser demonic spirit. Nevertheless, this entity went forward and oppressed her sexually just the same, apparently because this was her point of greatest vulnerability. The spirit inflamed her passions again and again until she was reduced to being a servant of impulse. At that juncture, the oppressing spirit was able to possess Lonnie at will, which was when she began to have experienced memory gaps. Having spent well over an hour interviewing this couple, and I should mention the boyfriend wasn't too pleased with what he'd heard, I knew that for the girl's own safety, I had to arrange for an immediate exorcism. Otherwise, the entity, knowing that I knew it was possessing the girl, might take her over one last time and bring about a suicide situation. With that in mind, I went out in the hall and explained the problem to Lorraine, told her to take the rented car back to the hotel for the night. The three of us then drove in Alan's car to Lonnie's apartment. I spent the night watching old movies on television with Alan while she slept in a bedroom with the door open and a light on. The next morning, I put a call through to a local Protestant exorcist in whom I had great faith. I couldn't call on a Catholic exorcist at the time because their clergy has to follow Vatican policy and undergo a 3-day period of prayer and fasting before conducting any exorcism of the possessed. The exorcist and his assistant, both Protestant clergymen, arrived about an hour later. Both were capable men, and I explained the background of the case to them. Of course, they'd heard it all before. Then Lonnie was brought into the room. Up to this point, the clergyman had not witnessed the possession, nor had the girl been possessed since the night before. What I had to do first, therefore, was to prove to them that possession was in fact taking place. One of the many tests for possession is to discreetly place a crucifix behind the head of the possessed. So in this case, the exorcist instructed the girl to close her eyes and slowly count to 20. His assistant, already standing behind the girl, then placed a cross 6 inches behind her head. The entity possessing the girl suddenly The entity possessing the girl suddenly let go with shall I continue? You interested?